Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome back Dave Itzkoff and Keith Olbermann.
Thanks.
There you go. Oh, sorry.
Okay. We rehearsed that part, as you could tell.
You know, before any other words get said, I just really have to thank Keith. I know you braved some personal discomfort in a case of the shingles to be here today, and I so appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave, and my shingles say thank you to you all. And it did occur to me in the last week that the one thing that Chayefsky left out of this is that whether or not you believe Howard Beale heard the voice of God or was simply having delusions, clearly the plot device that would have explained this would have been if in the week preceding his episode he'd had shingles. I always like to check before we do anything. Great Ahmed Khan in here anywhere? Because I can speak to you as a veteran now of 34 years, coming up on 35, in television and radio news and sports at every level, from college radio to networks, that everything you saw there has happened to me or a friend of mine, except getting killed from the audience. I mean, physically, metaphorically, that happened on a frequent basis. But I think this is a good starting point for Dave and myself. Is there a way to recreate for people how prophetic this is? Because as great a film as this still is, nothing really seems, other than perhaps the murder of the anchor for bad ratings, none of it seems implausible now. But there was a time when this was a nightmare to the average viewer.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even you know, and that was in the period that the film was released. You know, if you look at the film reviews that were written about Network when it came out in 1976, and I mean, there were a lot of certainly people savaged it, and certainly people loved it. But even the people who supported it, there was this thread of, you know, this is just an outlandish, far out satire, and could never happen. And now we watch it, and it's just standard operating procedure. I mean, we don't even bat an eyelash at some of the things.
In part of your research, although you didn't ask me to do this, I did it anyway.
And I appreciate it.
I gave Dave a list of the things. I took a fresh, you know, look at the film and wrote down the number of prophecies, things that changed that Paddy Chayefsky got right. The list takes 5 pages. It's 23 separate things. But the most, to me, the most enduring one, there are two of them actually, the most enduring two, are the reactions to people who get emotional. Let's use that as a catch-all phrase, from whether you look in a camera and go, "How dare you, sir?" Not that I'm referring to anybody in particular. But if you have, from that range to people weeping on television, to people going perhaps a little mental on television, in the days prior to this film and in maybe 10, 15 years afterwards, somebody would have, any one of these things that happens to Howard Beale, he would be off air for quite a while.
Right.
We had a local anchor in New York 35 years ago who was being replaced, and he thought it'd be funny to bring out a fake bomb into the newsroom. Like, if I'm going to go, I'm going to take all of you with me. He thought this showed that he was taking it well. Two truths. He was off the air for 8 months, and then he came back and got another job at a different station. So it's not the pristine past before this movie, but essentially bad behavior is now rewarded, and this is the first example of it, essentially, in news.
Right. I mean, it's not just bad behavior, but a sort of an emotional behavior, or a kind of, you know, the crossing of the line of, you know, what is you know, truthful news, what is just a sort of straight down the line recounting of the facts, versus, you know, the injection of emotion into it. And you see it with Beale, it happens kind of gradually. I mean, it's, he makes, even the way that the William Holden character sort of says it jokingly to him at the very beginning of the film, making the jokes about the Death Hour and very sarcastically saying, you know, wouldn't that be a great show? And then little by little, you see, you know, Beale's show and you see the UBS lineup becoming what Holden sort of jokingly alluded to, that even Beale's first speech is kind of a throwaway gag, oh, I'm going to commit suicide. And then little by little, his speeches become, you know, more and more, you know, just emotional and off the cuff and having less and less to do with actual news.
The second thing that has struck me the longer I've been in the business and the more times I've watched this, and I've probably seen this 50, 60 times at this point, the wall that was supposed to prevent this from happening was this idea that, yes, the networks lost $20, $30 million annually in news operation money in the 60s and 70s, but as part of the FCC deal, they were allowed to make limitless money off of shows like the Beverly Hillbillies in exchange for essentially providing a public service, and the news divisions were sacrosanct. They were inviolable, to use the old Roman sense of it. You could not go and cut budgets. And it was assumed when this film came out that when the inevitable financial assault would occur, for whatever reason, that people would stand up, the Max Schumachers would stand up and say, no, We're walking out. Nothing.
Yeah. Well, that scene, you know, when you first meet Robert Duvall and he's introduced to William Holden and he goes up, you know, I've had it up to here with your cruddy news division and it's $33 million annual loss. I mean, that is not a figure that Chayefsky is pulling out of thin air. I mean, that's really, you know, that's how much it costs to run a news division in 1976. And that is really what, you know, how things were done, that, you know, a news division was not expected to be profitable, that was part of the public service that it provided in exchange for, you know, having a kind of semi-monopoly on the airwaves. And, you know, what's exactly dramatized in the conflict between Schumacher and the Faye Dunaway character is, you know, she's the entertainment executive who has her eye on a news program, and she's going to convert news into entertainment. That's what, you know, so many of the news business veterans, the people working in news at the time, found, you know, offensive about the film. That could never transpire. Little did they know.
They'd be bringing sportscasters in to do the news. I mean, it's just.
I hope that day never comes.
No, God help us. Although I am available in a year and 4 months for my sportscasting contract. That's a joke. I'm very happy doing this. Although I have the shingles. What was it? We were talking about this as we were watching. Backstage, sort of listening to you, watching you watch it, the secret recording devices throughout the room. the reaction to it from Hollywood and the what was then a sort of separate but sort of a cousin-like industry called television, and now it's all one thing. Obviously, it's just the entertainment. The reaction for the process of getting this done. I mean, this was not like getting Citizen Kane made, but I imagine some of those problems would not have seemed foreign to Orson Welles, the ones that affected the making of this film.
Yeah, there are some analogies in the sense that even in the course of producing the film, I mean, you'll notice a lot of the, you know, the portions of the movie that are taking place in a sort of real live television studio, all of, you know, Howard Beale's news segments, they had to shoot that in an operating TV studio, and they could not find one in New York because none of the networks or the local broadcasters would let them use their facilities for a film like this. They just didn't want to be associated with it, and so they had to go up to Toronto to do all those live news portions of the film. Even the sequence where, you know, Ned Beatty gives his fantastic speech about, you know, you have meddled with the primal forces of nature, that was originally going to be shot in the boardroom of the New York Stock Exchange until they got a hold of Chayefsky's script and they saw that there was all this language about, you know, there are no nations, there are only corporations, and of course they wanted nothing to do with it. So the New York Public Library let them use their boardroom for that scene.
They didn't ask NBC for the use of the 52nd floor of 30 Rock by any chance?
I suspect that would have been a non-starter.
Yeah. I wish it had been a non-starter in my case, but that's where mine was. So as I said, I'll leave the details out of it, but when I was having the real life version of that, I kept going, shouldn't he put the lights down and yell at me more? the idea that these walls that were to protect the news on television from everything else turned out to be made out of paper. There was nothing to it. What's the reaction? I mean, we also discussed this now, the reaction of the TV newscasters of the time, the TV people of the time, compared to now.
Well, certainly in that era, you know, I mean, there was a huge distaste for the film, partly because, you know, Chayefsky had gotten access to the news divisions of the networks in the course of just doing research for his script, that because he had, you know, clout still in the entertainment industry, he had people who could vouch for him, and he was allowed to, you know, just view the day in progress at NBC, CBS, take notes. They didn't know what kind of a film he was going to write, and he didn't really know what kind of a film he was going to write. And the fact that it turned out to be something so savage, I think they felt very used. And he even went as far as to write letters of apology to Walter Cronkite and to John Chancellor after the film came out. And I mean, if you know anything about Chayefsky at all, I mean, he was not a man who easily apologized for anything. So the fact that he felt concerned that he had somehow betrayed their trust, I mean, that was, you know, that was a real worry to him. But at large, the business kind of distanced itself and disowned it, you know, because they've, as you were saying earlier, I mean, they felt like they were this unimpeachable industry, that, you know, how could this could never happen to us, and how dare somebody even suggest it?
Yeah.
So that was then.
Yeah, that was then. Right. Who is there? Did he role model anybody? Did either Peter Finch or Paddy Chayefsky look at someone in particular for the character of Beale, or at a group of people, or their component parts?
Not so much. I mean, in the very early drafts of the script, he has this kind of catch-all name for the character called Crazy Cronkite. But I think he only... I think that's more of a kind of Borscht Belt comedy thing, that, you know, the letter, that hard K sound is just a funny sound. And so I don't think he deliberately meant it as a reduction of Cronkite. He did observe Cronkite as he, you know, conducted his business. He looked at John Chancellor, but really more just to see, you know, what does a news anchor actually do? How is his day conducted? And he saw, at least in that era, that a news anchor was very, closely involved with the organization of that day's broadcast. He was not just, you know, a talking head who went out and read a teleprompter and then went home at night.
Studied local television news more than the networks for this purpose?
There was a little bit of both. And there was, you know, he certainly looked at what was happening, for example, in the local markets of Boston, which was a very competitive news market. And also at San Francisco, there was a very famous 60 Minutes segment produced, I think, in 1973, where Mike Wallace looks at the market there, which had gone almost totally tabloid. I mean, you literally had a local news broadcast there that was leading with segments about, you know, severed male organ found on train tracks.
Train tracks, yeah.
Yes. And this was succeeding in San Francisco, and it was, you know, terribly dispiriting to the sort of, you know, the hardened news professionals in that industry. So, he's seeing the sort of confluence of, you know, on the one hand, the tabloidization of the local news, on the other hand, the sort of, you know, the network news, and the increasing corporate pressure that's going to come under, and what's going to happen when those things collide.
So the context of this was the starting point for him, was it as those of us who were sort of amateur students of this movie before you became the professional student of it, was it the Christine Chubbuck incident? And explain what that was.
You know, that's an interesting point that you bring up. I mean, there was, sadly, a real-life incident in 1974 where a local anchor in a Florida market actually went on the air, and as she's closing up her broadcast for the day, you know, she says to the audience something to the effect of, you know, in keeping with our policy of, you know, bringing you the latest in news, you're going to see a live suicide, and then literally does pick up a revolver and put it to her temple and shoot herself. Now, this was an incident that did occur while Chayefsky was writing the screenplay, but it was not the specific inspiration for it. And in fact, he does have a draft where he refers, you know, at one point he has Beale say something like, you know, I'm going to blow my brains out like that girl in Florida. But he never followed through on that line. If anything, I think, you know, you can see the movie almost as a summation of a lot of ideas that were in Chayefsky's work going back, you know, all the way even to his sort of TV career in the Golden Age in the 1950s, all the way back even to something like Marty, where, you know, he was always interested in these kinds of protagonists who were tightly wound up people and then were finally given an opportunity to just kind of let loose and have these big explosive moments, and then once they do, they can never be the same again.
I want to get back to talking about Chayefsky and the production of the film and Sidney Lumet and how they worked hand in hand, but you've referred several times to those emotional moments, and clearly the one in this one, although many of us are devotees of the Ned Beatty scene. You have meddled with the primal forces of... Yeah. The mad as hell speech, and there's so many, they're fascinating pieces of that that really relate to the chronology of making the film that I found astounding. But when those extraordinary, the huge buildup, the man's career and what you've seen of it lead up to that moment where he comes in from the rain, and that was done when?
Well, some of those portions of that speech are shot on the very first day of filming of Network. I mean, imagine the first day of shooting Gone with the Wind and, you know, Clark Gable doing the Frankly, My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn speech.
Or Welcome, Burn It.
Right. but, you know, so like the portions of it, some parts of that speech you're watching Beale live in a studio, other portions you're watching him on other people's TV sets. That had to be shot on video first so they could then run it on a screen. So those video portions literally are shot on the very first day of filming the movie. The rest, the sort of in-studio portion, is just a few days later within the first week. And they're, you know, asking of Peter Finch to basically, you know, give the performance of your career a week into filming this movie.
The idea that this film also meant the end, literally, for Peter Finch, have you been able to establish just how much this did take out of him, and how much of his health was already a foregone conclusion, or lack of health, obviously, yeah, going into it? I mean, what sort of state was he in, and how much further did the making of this film, and obviously considerable emotional expense, yeah, do to him?
Well, I mean, he had been very clean in his life, you know, up to this point. I mean, he obviously was, you know, he led a very, you know, lively and zesty career earlier, and you know, a great pal of folks like, you know, Peter O'Toole and that whole sort of, you know, cadre of British actors. But by this time, you know, I mean, he was really in a kind of semi-retirement, and he has to be sort of conjured up from his home in Jamaica to come into New York just to audition for the film at a point when they had really exhausted every other sort of viable candidate. But, you know, as far as they, you know, there is a sense that he was healthy enough to do it, except when they shoot the actual Mad as Hell speech, for example, you know, Lumet has it organized so that they can shoot, you know, one take in its entirety, then has another camera, you know, already loaded up with film, ready to go, and they get about halfway through that second take, and Finch, you know, just halts the shooting of it and just tells Lumet, you know, I can't go anymore. This is all I can do. And Lumet allows that, and, you know, just sort of sees something in Finch that really was all he had. So again, the Mad as Hell speech that you see in this movie is comprised of, you know, one and a half takes of an actor's work.
Extraordinary. Let's talk about Chayefsky and how he got to the point of making this film and go into this relationship where a director was willing to have the auteur sitting as close as we're sitting now, going 3 feet to the left.
So, you know, at this point, you know, Chayefsky has already won two Academy Awards in his career, you know, at very different periods in history. I mean, first for Marty, which would have been in, you know, 1955, and then 16 years later for The Hospital, which is almost sort of a dry run for Network. But in the meantime, Chayefsky's had a kind of wandering in the wilderness professionally. I mean, he's gone from TV to movies to theater back to TV, and always dissatisfied with at least the outcome of his writing, that either he didn't get to exert enough control over the work, or, you know, something got changed somewhere along the line. The message that he was trying to get across to his audience was not received in the way that he intended. So, you know, between the esteem that he has built up and his perpetual search for control, he's evolved the situation where he will only take on movies where he can basically be the one in charge of everything. And you may have seen in the opening credits of Network, it does not say, you know, screenplay by Paddy Chayefsky. It does not say written by Paddy Chayefsky. It says by Paddy Chayefsky. And that's because he has even more authority than Sidney Lumet. Lumet, to his great credit, has to accept a situation on this movie where he's going to be almost co-equal with a screenwriter, if not, you know, subordinate to him. And that's unheard of.
How did that work in practicality? I mean, was he literally saying 3 feet to the left, or did he not care what it looked like?
what he was most concerned about for Chayefsky was not so much the composition of the frame or what the shot looked like or how even words were enunciated, but just that you say exactly what he wrote on the page. That was the greatest concern to him. And if you got a line wrong, he wouldn't even necessarily come up to you and say it. He would tell the script supervisor, who he would then delegate to tell you, actually, it's, you know, it should be this and not that. Although, the one thing he was not able to stop was that, if you notice, when Peter Finch is giving the speech, he says, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. Every other iteration of the phrase, when it's being shouted from the windows and the rooftops, people are saying, I'm mad as hell. There isn't that extra as that Finch got to slip in.
And yet they get to own both of them. Either one works just fine, and they're interchangeable.
Yeah, I think maybe that's why nobody noticed, or maybe they noticed late enough in editing, and they hoped that you and I would never bring it up 38 years later.
And yet they made huge changes in the film. You talked about casting Peter Finch and the audition process. Who else was considered that? And then you can reveal in your book, exclusively for the first time, anybody who knows anything about this film knows Ned Beatty helicoptered in. Shot all that stuff in a couple of days or one day?
Yeah, one day.
Everything is one day, and then got out because they had somebody else for it, and it didn't work out. And before your book, try to find that information anywhere. So tell the two stories. Who else was considered for Howard Beale, and how did Ned Beatty get there?
Sure. So for Beale, they really just, I mean, they practically went through the phone book. Chayefsky writes a letter directly to Paul Newman, you know, sending him a copy of the script and saying, you know, you can have any part you want, but I really hope you'll consider Howard Beale. Obviously, that didn't get anywhere. And, you know, Chayefsky also went back to George C. Scott, who had been his star in The Hospital. At that point, you know, Scott is starring in Death of a Salesman on Broadway, and Scott strongly implies that, you know, he'll only do it if his wife, Trish Vanderveer, can play the Faye Dunaway role. So that obviously didn't get anywhere. But, you know, they thought about people like, you know, Jimmy Stewart. They thought about Walter Matthau. I mean, just anybody, Robert Montgomery, anybody who was a name in that era. And, you know, all these people, if they were ever even offered it, if their agent ever even bothered to tell them, hey, you're up for this role, everyone shot it down because, you know, I mean, there was something, it was just, there was a clear controversy to it. It was, you know, it was vulgar. It was, you know, it just, nobody wanted to touch it. And Finch got it because, you know, his manager was just persistent and just kept asking for auditions. So that's the Finch story.
His network with Walter Matthau. I'm mad as hell. And I'm not going to take this anymore. All right, tell the.
Did you guys know you were going to pay to see Keith Olbermann do a Walter Matthau impression today? If you didn't get your money's worth.
You paid to see me do a Howard Beale impression for many years, so why not? Tell the Beatty story,
sure,
because that's also
sure.
who he had planned, and
right.
That's just, it's a different film if the other person is doing it.
Absolutely. So, you know, the character of Arthur Jensen, who's the chairman of CCA, that was originally going to be played by a character actor named Roberts Blossom. And you might know him from The Hospital. He has, you know, he's the patient at the beginning of the movie who gets diagnosed to death. He's also, if you know the Home Alone movie with Macaulay Culkin, he's the sort of goggle-eyed old man that Culkin is afraid of and then later befriends. But in the rehearsal process, Lumet and Chayefsky couldn't quite agree on how he should play the character and ultimately realized he just was not the right guy to do the role. So they're like days away from actually shooting the scene. Robert Altman had recommended Ned Beatty from making Nashville with him. And Beatty comes in and, you know, true to this sort of salesman-like character that he's auditioning for, he tells Chayefsky and Lumet, you know, you guys can take as much time as you like, but I've got this other offer for this other movie, and it's got to either be this or that, and you guys got to let me know. And he goes in the other room. They quickly talk it over. They say, okay, Beatty, you're our man, and does the scene. Meanwhile, Beatty was lying through his teeth and had no other offer that he was considering. But I guess they saw their Arthur Jensen in him when he said that to them.
Yeah, so some things work out even at the last minute when they get changed. I want to just a quick show of hands. Did anybody see this for the first time today? All right, so a good percentage of you saw it for the first time today. So how you come to this film is, I mean, you're welcome to the cult, is what I'm saying. Because you can watch it and watch it and watch it and watch it, and there's always something new. But I thought it'd be, my story of how I joined the cult is not difficult. This came out when I was in college and was aspiring to a career in radio and television, sports, but also possibly news someday. So this was like required viewing. How did you come to this, Dave?
Well, I made the mistake of telling Keith this story backstage.
How did you come to this, Dave? Because it's much better than my story.
At least you came by it sincerely. I seem to recall a Mad Magazine parody of Network called Nutwork. And what was so enticing to me at, you know, age 5 or 6, I mean, I had no idea who they were caricaturing, who, you know, Faye Dunaway was or William Holden was. But one of the running jokes in the parody is that, you know, the language of Network is so obscene and so filthy that it's got to be censored in Mad. And they use these funny little, you know, curse symbols to bleep out the language that, you know, exclamation points and hashtags and question marks on a little planet that looks like Saturn. And I, you know, at that age, I was just so enticed of like, what is this movie that is so filthy that even Mad can't really reproduce what it's saying? And it just made me want to seek this thing out.
All right. So that's, as I said, that was a better story than mine.
It's the cultural value of Mad Magazine and, you know, the debt that we all owe it.
All I got was Spy Re-Spy. Right. That's what I got out of it. It was enough. That brings us back to something here that, again, every frame of that film is prophetic, and you have to set yourself back to really appreciate that element of it to what a newscast looked like in 1975. But we were discussing briefly what's left. And the language may be the only thing that's left, because there are no broadcast television shows, certainly no news shows, in which the anchors are allowed to use. I get notes about, with my current employers, suck is not an ESPN word. So we're still in a kind of...
As an employee of the New York Times, I can't even allow myself. I have to pretend I didn't hear
you
that.
You couldn't quote me saying that.
Nope.
So there's still, you know, we joked also that if that sort of swearing that Howard Beale does on the air were to actually come into place in newscasts, Sue Simmons would be out of retirement in a matter of hours. And the highest paid anchor in New York City. She might have the network gig because she was just, you know... Hi, what the F are you doing? Would be the greeting. It'd be the most famous thing in radio. But that's there's what is there anything left? Because we talked about how Craig Ferguson does his show. My friend Ferguson does his show live in front of an audience of about this size and swears like a sailor who's just learned how to swear. I mean, he just doesn't stop, and the guests swear, and I've gone on there and sworn, and it's liberating, and yes, I'm going to just gratuitously swear now. And
but it's all bleeped,
and then it's bleeped and pixelated, so it's covered. But we were discussing the possibility that someday they'll just say that's $400 every time we pixelate that. So let the language go. Who cares anymore? Is that the last thing left?
You know, either that or, you know, just nudity on network news. Maybe that's the last threshold. I don't know if you want to be the
one.
There's
no nudity on the network news here. Fortunately, in this film, there's nudity of Faye Dunaway, right. But it has nothing to do with the newscast, right?
No, but that, you know, that was a very provocative scene. I mean, that was maybe one of the most challenging scenes to get shot. I mean, that was the scene that almost had Dunaway literally walking off the shoot, and they would have been back to square one. I mean, that was a scene that she just did not want to do.
And obviously it derailed her career because she hasn't worked at all in the last 37 years, right?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot transpires between, you know, this film's release in 1976 and, say, you know, 1981, where, you know, one by one, all the people involved with this film, I mean, this really was, you know, sort of a high point for all of them. It's not only Chayefsky's magnum opus, but it's, you know, really the last great performance perhaps that William Holden gives, and it's certainly as great a performance as Faye Dunaway gives. I mean, she works very steadily, but you know only in, you know, sort of passion projects like Mommy Dearest, and we know the fate of those kinds of films.
But and we were also talking about this before. You can watch this film, and you go, my goodness, Holden, Finch, Faye Dunaway. You can go through some of the character actors and be absolutely amazed by the giant performances and the terrific jobs and the realistic qualities to them and everything else. And the guy who you list last among the top four or five would be Robert Duvall, and that's not justified. He is so good. you don't even think he's acting. Yeah. It's literally that. That's how good a performance that was.
As I was telling Keith backstage, I mean, just in the last sort of the last few viewings of the film, as I've been, you know, going to events like these or just preparing to talk about the book, I really have been taken by that character arc in particular. That, I mean, there is, even for a character who is sort of as, you know, nakedly ambitious and, you know, to the extent that there are any villains in this film, I mean, he certainly falls on that side of the spectrum. And yet, you know, I mean, his trajectory from his perspective, from his standpoint, it makes total sense to him. And even in that moment at the end when he gives his, you know, I'm a man without a network speech, I mean, you almost kind of feel for him.
Well, having been a man without a network,
I should have chosen my words more carefully.
Several,
I'm sorry.
No, it's in the film. Several different occasions. I've had a certain amount of empathy there. Did Chayefsky ever fleetingly even think of revisiting this topic? I mean, I know he wasn't for that. He wanted to revisit a mood and take it from places like a metropolitan New York hospital to a television network, from the streets that Marty lived on. It's the same point of view. It's a totally different world each time. But did he ever give a fleeting thought to, you know, what this network looks like 3 months after the assassination of Howard Beale?
not really. And he doesn't, you know, sadly, I mean, he doesn't have much more opportunity to create anything after Network. The only other film that he would be involved in, you know, I mean, the film comes out in 76 and he dies in 1981. The only film that he makes after this is Altered States, which is, you know, just a devastating experience for him. That, you know, they go through, first Arthur Penn is directing it and they kick him off. They bring in Ken Russell, who, you know, he and Chayefsky just did not get along at all. And, you know, Russell kicks him off the set basically after the first day of filming. Chayefsky, you know, felt he lost control of that movie and won't even take a screen credit for it. He uses a pseudonym, Sidney Aaron, as the screenwriter of Altered States. So Network is the last movie he ever really even puts his name on.
Can you recreate the reaction within Hollywood? And we talked earlier about how this affected television, but was Hollywood very happy to see Pat H. Chayefsky kind of shunted to the side after this?
Well, you know, it's not solely because of the film. I mean, the film, of course, is, you know, it's a box office success. They made it on a budget of about $4 million, and it took in about $20 million in 2 years, which for that era is sensational. You know, nominated for 10 Oscars and won 4, and really never should have lost to Rocky. I don't know how that happened. But, you know, within a year, you know, I mean, it wins, you know, its Oscars in 1977. In 78, you have the very famous Academy Awards face-off between Vanessa Redgrave and Patty Chayefsky, where, you know, she makes, you know, her remarks about, you know, the Zionist hoodlums. He comes back a few hours later in the show and says, you know, nobody was asking for Miss Redgrave's opinion and a simple thank you would have sufficed. And even that becomes a very sort of polarizing moment that, you know, there are a lot of people who supported Chayefsky for making those remarks and a lot of people who felt like, you know, it wasn't his place to say anything and that, in effect, he had become the Howard Beale that he anticipated. He was the sort of, you know, the cranky old prophet and, you know, who really needed to hear from him in that moment. It sort of confirmed, you know, the suspicions there, the stereotype that people wanted him to fulfill. But
didn't they always view him that way, that this is you just shut up and, you know, write a simple script that we can all dance to?
There was a certain amount of that, I think, even in the months before Network. There's a New York Times article that is written about him, I think just at the turn of 76, right before the film goes into production, where, you know, he's talking to a reporter who's almost kind of, you know, gently mocking him for not having written, you know, anything in the last 4 or 5 years, and the writer asks him if he's got anything else that he's working on, and he's, you know, working on a comedy. And
is that lost here too? How funny this film is? Has that been because of the anger and the Howard Beale as a character in this bizarre environment in which a man threatening suicide is rewarded and put on television every night? Do we lose not just the dark humor that's built into it, but also those laugh-out-loud moments throughout the film?
You know, I understand what you're asking, but I don't think so. I mean, it's really a joy to get to come to these kinds of screening events and seeing these lines land, you know, just as powerfully 38 years later, and the things that we laugh at, I think, you know, we're meant to laugh at that. You know the disconnect between just some of the brutal things that William Holden and Peter Finch are saying in that first bar scene, and this disgusting landscape that Holden is envisioning. I mean, it's funny not only because, you know, we'll wipe that fucking Disney right off the map. I mean, that's just a funny line, but the fact that the things that he's describing have even come to pass. I mean, we laugh at it in a whole new way.
It's called True TV Network. They have edited highlights of automobile smash-ups for like 3 hours a night. What they were wrong about was that it was only going to be 1 hour. Because whereas, and this is I think absolutely true. You can see it in the film whenever all the other networks suddenly ABC. We don't hear about CBS, I don't think, but we hear ABC has got that new profit lined up for next year. Right, who's going to go on against Howard Beale? They're going to have two prophets and one, you know, two newscasts at 6:30, 7 o'clock at night. But in television, everything that works is then stolen and reused, or hey, that worked, let's do it, but make it louder. It's always been that way. So the only mistakes in terms of prophecy here were that there were still limits to it. Would you agree with that?
I think so. I mean, and again, you know, think about the fact that he is writing in an era where, you know, it is only the monolithic networks. There's really no cable TV. The idea of the internet. I mean, nobody would know what that meant in 1976. And, you know, now we're living in an era of a sort of a multitude of Howard Beales, and you can go not just to any, you know, television channel, but you can go to any website and find, you know, the Howard Beale who speaks most directly to you. And you know, you really have to, if you know, you wonder. I mean, somebody tweeted at me this morning, you know, what would Chayefsky think of Twitter? And I said he would not be glad as hell.
I don't think we've discussed this previously. Did he view it quite as prophetically as we do, with the advantage of the 40 years nearly of events that have changed television news? Or did he just see it as, again, shifting everything in the room over, and if this key thing happens, this wall breaks down, these will be the consequences?
You know, I think his own sort of feelings about the movie vacillated a little bit. You know, if you asked him on a certain day if he was feeling really terrible about the state of TV, he might say, yes, this is a literal prediction of what I think is going to happen. On other days, I think he would make the case that this was never specifically or solely about television, and this was a bigger story about, you know, just people being alienated from each other, and, you know, media being a vehicle for that alienation. And I think actually he spent the last years of his life in some ways being very disappointed by the fact that, in some ways, the messages of this movie he felt were not received, and that in some ways the movie actually gets reduced just to the Howard Beale catchphrase of "I'm mad as hell." And, you know, you can look at, you know, dozens of press clippings from the years that follow network's release of that, you know, that phrase just being repeated over and over whenever somebody wants to invoke someone's anger. There's even a great clip in the movie Argo, if you've seen it. You know, it's real news footage they're using. It's just a sort of man on the street interview with a guy who's talking about how upset he is about the Iranian hostage situation, and he says, "I'm like that Howard Beale guy. I'm mad as hell." And, you know, so the movie does really become this vehicle for people's frustration. But, you know, again, to Chayefsky, it's not the only thing that he meant for the film to do. And the fact that it gets sort of, you know, consolidated to that one idea, I think, becomes a disappointment for him.
But this wasn't like Altered States. He was happy with the product itself.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he would later say, you know, even in some of the final interviews that he gave, you know, before he died, that this was, of all the films he made, this was his favorite one.
You've done a lot of events for your book, which is...
This was the best one, by the way.
Well, thank you.
By far.
Give me a moment here. I still could screw it up. My point in invoking that was, and the book is terrific, and it makes perfect reading, especially if you've just seen the film. But with your experience here, what have I left out? What are people asking about? What are things that you've observed that I have not asked you about while we've been sitting here?
You know, I don't know if this will be, you know, germane or useful to you, but, you know, I think, you know, I mean, for as much as this movie has kind of endured, I mean, it always to me, it always seemed like it was coupled with this kind of urban legend that Chayefsky specifically wrote it as a kind of act of revenge, that, you know, he either wanted to get back at the TV industry at large for having, you know, wronged him or turned its back on him somehow, or, it was meant to target specific people and satirize them. And I'm fairly certain that that's not true. I think if you really look at how the script was assembled and really how long he had been kind of almost rehearsing this, over the years of his career, I mean, there were many ideas in this film that he had been thinking about for a very long time. And just the fact that he's sort of flabbergasted at the news business and TV business is so stung by the film. And that was never really his intention. And this is not a revenge fantasy of his in any way.
Yeah, there'd be no way for him to revenge himself against the news people with whom he never worked. I mean, he had no background. He would have had dealings with network programmers and such, but even then, he is superimposing them onto a different kind of construct, right?
Yeah, and I think it's somewhat an unfair, it's such a sort of reduction of what he was personally investing in this script, and what he hoped it would accomplish was, you know, far vaster than really what a movie can do. But he tried. I mean, there are so – you look around, you don't see very many screenwriters these days, I would think, who are willing to basically, you know, use the resources of one, you know, mass media organization to indict another. I mean, that was a very risky thing to do in that day, and it's amazing that he got away with it.
Yeah, well, they'll get you eventually. I know that. So having been in those meetings, they will eventually get you. The idea of what you want to see after this and related materials, and once again, I'll plug Dave's book, Mad as Hell. You should buy it. You should read it. It's really good. And for anybody who's aficionado of this film, you are going to get such added value, and you go, oh, that's what that is about, or the backstory, and then watch the film again, and you will enjoy it twice as much as you did. But in terms of other films, we already talked about The Hospital, but let's give The Hospital and one other film some props while we're out here.
Oh, yeah, you want to talk about Face in the Crowd?
Let's do The Hospital first. Oh, okay. Explain, for people who haven't seen it, it's kind of an unrelated prequel in many respects.
Right, and this is a film, it's sort of a dry run for network in a sense. It's set, you know, in a New York hospital in 1971. I mean, if you think hospitals in New York are bad now, I mean, you should see how shabby this, I think it was Metropolitan Hospital that they filmed in, which is already about 100 years old at the time. And, you know, it's about a doctor who is the head of medicine or chief of surgery, played by George C. Scott, and, you know, basically, he gives a kind of almost a Howard Beale-like speech in the middle of a rainstorm.
He's about an hour and a half before Howard Beale's breaking point, right, when he's giving this speech. He gets to the explosion, not quite as crazy as Howard Beale.
Right. But the speech about, you know, we heal nothing, we cure nothing. And, I mean, this is a man who is a medical professional. And, you know, he'd basically given up on his own job.
And Diana Rigg, Barnard right. Hughes, a cast, an unbelievable cast in that film.
Robert Blossom
playing the old man. A great film. But then we have to also go, that's another Chayefsky film that you might enjoy after seeing this, if you saw this for the first time. And then there is the kind of ancient ancestor to this called, and I'm still surprised to this day that more people don't know about this film, called A Face in the Crowd, which is extraordinary on so many levels that we could have another 40 minutes talking about just that, but relate it to this film.
Sure. And so that, I mean, I'm sure people know, I mean, that stars Andy Griffith as a kind of, a homespun, he starts off first as a kind of a musician, right? And then...
Well, he's a bum. He's,
right.
he's a hobo with a guitar who's in jail for drunk and disorderly.
Right.
That's clearly his life's calling.
Right.
And then suddenly he winds up...
is given a broadcasting job, right, and works his way up.
Supposedly he's Arthur Godfrey.
Oh, is that right?
Arthur Godfrey turned into a country western kind of folksy figure, but with that kind of pervasiveness in media and influence on politics, where, you know, 10 years before he'd been giving the weather on a radio station in Washington. So it's that kind of equally dystopian but very specific to what happens if you let one guy who's good at it get away with it.
Exactly. Right. I mean, when you turn, you know, I mean, there is a certain amount of responsibility to turning the airwaves over to anyone, and that if you when you put it in the hands of the wrong person or somebody who has ulterior motives, I mean, it can truly be, you know, manipulated.
Andy Griffith in that film is so evil, so fantastically, thoroughly evil that if you get the DVD with the 45-minute interview with him, he explains that he could never play a mean character again because he drew so many things out of himself, and he didn't want to see those things again in his own personality. So that's how good a performance that was, and it does serve as I think you watch that first and then see Network, but you get there is a through line between the two of them. Yeah. Did Chayefsky like that film? Do we have any evidence that he saw it?
I imagine he must have, but it's not something that it was sort of not a direct antecedent in the sense that, you know, he sat down and studied it and, you know, wrote about it. But I have to, there are, when you look at the lineage of, you know, movies commenting on media, I mean, it's a very finite number of them. It would not, you know,
I don't know where the script is. Yeah. Apparently it burned all copies along with the director and the writer.
Right. I mean, it would not take up a shelf at, you know, Kim's Video or wherever. So, I mean, I'm sure it's something that must have, you know, crossed his radar, but I think he was, you know, his antenna were pointed in every single direction, and anything you could be afraid of or worried about in 1976, he was definitely concerned about and trying to channel into one screenplay.
So if this is it for media criticism or television news criticism, this'll do, right?
Yeah, I hope there is more to come. I hope there are future screenwriters who are that ambitious, and, you know, maybe somebody will try to write a single movie about, you know, the decline of healthcare and, you know, drones and, you know, war in the Middle East, and try to get all those things under one roof. But, you know, one guy already tried that, and we saw the results of it
today. Lord knows we have enough of the drones on television news as it is. We don't need to do a movie about it. Dave Itzkoff, congratulations on the book. It was fantastic.
Thank you so much for being here, Keith. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I hope we added something to it. Read his book. See A Face in the Crowd if you haven't seen it already, and please see The Hospital, and we don't get a dime for that. Oh, Dave gets a dime for the book, though, so thanks. Thanks very much for having us.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.